Welcome to The Book Show. Tonight you'll hear from Rob Doyle about his latest book, This Is The Ritual.
Many of the pieces in the book are, you know, comical and exuberant, and I like to think very readable.
And we find out whether using real lives in fiction is an act of theft with Andrew O'Hagan.
They bleed into each other so naturally now that sometimes fiction's the only way to tell the news.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Bookshow RTE. And first this evening, In a Dark, Dark Wood is a mystery novel set on a hen weekend that goes horribly wrong. The cover says somebody's getting married, somebody's getting murdered. And this modern whodunit has been optioned by Reese Witherspoon, with thousands of copies being sold. We met up with its writer, Ruth Ware, and she read for the book show.
I am running. I am running through moonlit woods with branches tearing at my clothes and my feet catching in the snow-bowed bracken. Brambles slash at my hands. My breath tears in my throat. It hurts. Everything hurts. But this is what I do. I run. I can do this. I must get there. I must get to the road before. And then there it is, a black snake of tarmac in the moonlight, and I can hear the roar of an engine coming, and the white lines shine so bright they hurt my eyes, the black tree trunks like slashes against the light. Am I too late? I force myself down the last 30 metres, tripping over fallen logs, my heart like a drum in my breast. James! And I'm too late. The car is too close. I can't stop it. I fling myself onto the tarmac, my arms outstretched. Stop!
And that was Ruth Ware reading there from In a Dark, Dark Wood. So for anybody who hasn't read In a Dark, Dark Wood, could you give us an overview of the story?
Well, it kind of starts with I wouldn't say every woman's worst nightmare, but certainly one of those awkward social situations where you get an email from someone that you maybe haven't seen for a little while, and they're inviting you to their hen party, or worse still, hen weekend. This is what happens to my main character, Nora, and it's an email from a woman that she hasn't seen for a long time, about 10 years. There's bad blood between them, but you don't immediately know what that is, but there's reasons that she's kind of reluctant to go to this. And then she starts to feel guilty in the way that you do. She wants to build bridges, so she decides, kind of against her better judgment, to accept. But the story's in two halves. So half of the story is what happens on the hen night, and the other half is 48 hours later. Nora has woken up in hospital. She suffered a head injury, so she can't immediately remember what's happened, but you know she's had some kind of catastrophic thing has happened to her.
When I was reading it, it struck me, as a big Agatha Christie fan, that it reminded me of 10 Little Indians, because you have this very claustrophobic setting. All these people are trapped in this remote place and the weather isn't helping. When you started the story, did you start with this image of people locked away together? And then you also mentioned 10 Little Indians at some point.
I'm a huge Christie fan, and I did, when I wrote the book, I didn't intentionally set out to channel her, but I read an awful lot of Agatha Christie as a teenager, and after I had finished it, a few people read it and said, it's very Christie-ish. And actually, I could see that, having kind of going back and looking at all the influences. But no, I don't think I set out to write a closed room mystery. It was just how the constrictions of the hen party setting lent itself to that. What I loved about the idea was the fact that hen parties bring together all sorts of disparate characters, people who don't know each other and people from different stages of the bride's life, and they kind of rub together slightly awkwardly, and you can sort of see people sizing each other up and trying to work out a part of the hen's character that they don't know, because part of the book is about the kind of different facets of our personalities that we present to our different friends, and how sometimes that's a kind of unintentional act of deception in a way. So part of what I wanted was to have these characters in this very enclosed setting and creating lots of good narrative friction with their tensions.
And have you ever been in a situation where you've been sort of in a confined space with people, hopefully not with a murder, but, you know, over a sustained period of time? Did you draw on something like that?
We've all had holidays where kind of tensions have built up a little bit. But I think I am a little bit like Nora, in that I do find social situations quite taxing. I'm quite an introverted person, not to her extent, I have to say. I do have a social life and I like going to parties. I'm more of a natural observer. I like to stand back and kind of watch other people, what they're doing. So that part of it is definitely drawn from my own character.
We have a small cast of characters, but Nora is a central character. But we meet her variously as Nora, as Leonora, as Lee, and which suggests that she might not be the most reliable narrator. Are you sort of playing with the reader in terms of doing that?
She's not the most reliable narrator, but what I quite like about her is that she's not intentionally unreliable. You know, I feel like I've read a lot of stories where the narrator or the author is kind of deliberately playing with the reader and withholding information. And Nora is as much in the dark as the reader. You pretty much find stuff out at the same pace as she does. But it's true that the story is about the facets of ourself that we present to other people, how much of our inner self we let people see. Also how we reinvent ourselves over time. And I think Nora's name changes are all part of that. She's been one way at school and she very consciously reinvents herself to be quite a different person as an adult and a different person in the professional sphere, which I think we all do. It's just that she kind of uses the names to symbolise to herself what, you know, the changes that she's made.
What are the elements of mystery that really excite you the most?
There's a lot of room for characterisation and atmosphere, but at the same time, they're technically fun to plot. You know, character is important and the relationships are important, but also just the kind of mechanics of setting up a really satisfying puzzle with a payoff. It's fun kind of deceiving the reader and trying to make them think one thing. But I think you do need both elements, because the problem is with a book that really stands or falls on its twist, and mine doesn't really have a twist, but you know, some books are more dependent on the twist. If you guess the twist, the book still has to stand up. So you have to care enough about the characters to read it independent of whether you've kind of one step ahead of the author. So yeah, being able to do both, I think, is what crime and thrillers do really, really well. I think when I sat down to write my own, the one thing I really, really wanted was to give people a reason to keep reading.
The other central character in this book is the bride-to-be, Claire, but she is a bit of a bridezilla, but she seems to be very popular and have a great life, but she's in this central situation that's very cut off, but she's quite manipulative in many ways.
She is quite manipulative, but I think they all are in a way. I think part of what I was working through in the book was lots of kind of complicated feelings about female friendships and the friendships we have when we're growing up and the importance of friendship to us, particularly when we're very young. You know, there's a stage in your life where your friends are literally the most important thing to you. They're more important than family. They're more important than relationships. And in a way, a hen party is a time that brings that back, I think, because it's one of the very few celebrations of friendship that we have in society. You know, most of our rituals are about romantic love or about family, and this one is it's a very public way of saying, these are the people who got me where I am today, they're the people that I rely on. And so it kind of felt like a natural time to explore both the good and the kind of bad side of friendship, and the way it can be quite a manipulative, power-driven relationship.
That was Ruth Ware, and In a Dark, Dark Wood is published by Bloomsbury. Now, Rob Doyle's debut novel, Here Are the Young Men, was a graphic coming-of-age story set in Dublin. His long-anticipated second book, This Is the Ritual, mixes forms from the short story to essay, and the cast of characters includes a writer called Rob Doyle. We asked the real Rob Doyle, we think, to tell us more about his new book.
Face covered against the pollution, she fumbled in her bag for a coin. The entire ritual had been tainted. If I had children, I would strangle them here and now. Under a metallic sky, composing music far away from the war. Valiant but vain attempts to find a common language. I love writing which blurs the boundaries between different genres, which is neither straight conventional fiction. And I also love fictional writing, which is very autobiographical, because I think that it turns up the heat in the room. It makes things that bit more intense when, even if it's not completely true what you're reading on the page, you really have the sense that the author is playing a dangerous game of exposure, revelation, maybe self-assassination. The opening story, John Paul Finnegan, paltry realist, is set on the Ulysses ferry between Holyhead and Dublin. It's about two men, one the narrator, also named Rob, and his friend, a kind of monomaniac called John Paul Finnegan. Two Irishmen who used to live together in London are now returning to Dublin after several years away. To say the least, they have a very ambivalent attitude towards their native land and their home city. "Consider the name of this very ship," said John Paul Finnegan. "In fact, don't even get me started on the name of this ship," he said. But it was too late, because he had already got himself started on the name of the ship, which was Ulysses. Everyone in Ireland pretends to have read Ulysses, or acts like they've read it, but none of them have. The last person in Ireland to read Ulysses was James Joyce, and even he only read half of it. I had great fun in this collection inventing the lives and the body of work of fictional authors. It allowed me to create the work that they left behind, the lives that they led. For example, the Irish author Killian Turner, who wrote some of the most transgressive and enigmatic texts in Irish literature in the 20th century, moved to West Berlin in the late 70s, where he got involved in some very strange things and disappeared mysteriously. Born into an upper middle class family in Dalkey, County Dublin, in 1948, Turner only began writing with any seriousness in his early 20s. It may be that Turner was prevented from writing as a younger man by the unhappiness of his home life. Maureen Turner, Killian's mother, died after complications resulting from the birth of her only child. Killian's father, Henry, was a history teacher in a private secondary school in Dalkey, and a man of trenchantly melancholy disposition. In the smog-choked winter evenings of Killian's boyhood and adolescence, Henry would call his son into his study. There, as Killian stood silently by his side, the father would issue sweeping utterances about the destruction inherent in the very cells of civilization, the transience of mankind, and the utter folly of all our humanistic dreams of progress, peace, and salvation. Many of the pieces in the book are, you know, comical and exuberant, and I like to think very readable, even though they kind of play around with the form and they do different things with the conventions of what a short story is and what people usually expect from such a thing. A couple of these stories are set in Ireland, but most of them are set in various cities and countries around the world, Mexico and Berlin and Paris and London and so on. But a great many of the characters are Irish, who are in some sense in flight from Ireland. Ireland in this book, I think, is very much a kind of scene of trauma, and a lot of people have been damaged by this country somehow, and they're escaping from it. They're trying to find new lives abroad, and they're getting into more trouble over there. But all of the characters have an ambivalent attitude towards Ireland. I spent several years drifting around, really, and wrote a lot while I was on the go. The fact that this collection is really set all over the world is reflected in the way it was written, which was all over the world and all over the place.
And thanks to Rob Doyle for talking to us. And his new book, This Is The Ritual, is published by Bloomsbury. Well, finally this evening, Andrew O'Hagan is a writer and contributing editor to the London Review of Books and Granta magazine. As part of the Abbey Theatre's recent Theatre for Change symposium, he spoke about the ethics of storytelling and using real lives as the basis for fiction writing. Andrew has written extensively on real and imagined lives of well-known personalities and missing people. The talk itself was called Stealing Lives, and I asked him whether he was doing just that, stealing lives, when writing.
Well, definitely, as you say. I mean, there's no moral, you know, height that a writer can claim to exist on when it comes to this. Writers must write, and they must write from the center of their imagination and their conviction. Now, what they can't do is self-censor and delete and pretend that something in life that impacted on them profoundly actually didn't. Bad writers make compensations, and I think what I was trying to say in that talk was that We really do have to face the fact that there's something morally indefensible about trying to write well. The results of good writing are always going to be painful to somebody, usually to yourself as a writer, but certainly there's a risk involved.
You've written about a gymnast like Lena Zavaroni in your work Personality, and you've written about Marilyn Monroe's life. You've also written about real people and missing people. What did you learn about writing about real people? What did you learn most from the experience?
It's an old problem in non-fiction writing, you know, to what extent are the scenes and the characters that you're dealing with imagined by you, and to what extent are they drawn from what we call real life? Of course, they're real people. If you write a novel, say, for example, with Al Capone at the centre of it, well, there was a real Al Capone, as we all know. We know his general history. You know, he was a mobster. You know, he was finally arrested on tax evasion and died. All those other things that happened in between, are they up for inventing, or must we stick to the facts? Now, I don't have a decisive answer to that. All I have is the experiment, book by book, article by article, essay by essay, that I can engage in. For the world, it's an ongoing, unanswerable. I would say that the exciting thing is to bring real lives into fiction, because I think they kind of belong there. We live now in a world that's more mediated and fictionalized. I'm talking about real life here. More fictionalized, more made up, more subject to the energies of fiction than any other time in history. So it seems to me that the relationship between what we call real life and writing has become very complicated. They bleed into each other so naturally now that sometimes fiction's the only way to tell the news.
One very non-fictional person you've been connected to is Julian Assange, and we all have our own sort of assumptions that we make about him because he is, you know, he's a product of the internet, if you like. What was your initial collaboration with him, and what were your impressions of him?
Well, I was invited by him to help him write his memoirs in 2010, and that would normally be something I didn't want to do. I mean, there's no reason to do that when you're busy and, you know, you want to be in command of your own books and your own essays, so why would I join in an enterprise like that? Except in his case, because of being so mediated, because being such a fictional construct, I felt that it would be revealing, at least to me, to test the limits of my own ability and test the limits of my own imagination almost, and see if I could write the true life novel of a very mediated life like that, if I could go inside that life and rip up the rules, ignore the categories, and find a new way. That's what writers and artists must always seek to do, find the new way, make it new, as Ezra Pound said. And for me, in connection to Assange, you know, it started off as quite an idealistic project. Once I decided I would go there to that house in Norfolk where he was under house arrest at the time, that I would sit down with him and look at the shape of his life and ideas and see what could be made of them. Well, I realised that that was easier to say than to do, because the man we're talking about was particularly under siege, to some extent under siege in his own head, quite narcissistic, and I thought rather sort of distracted from the part of his work that he did best. So it then became complicated, and what I did in the end was write a long essay telling the story of my attempt to get to grips with him in the situation. And that was a piece of work on its own. The book itself was neither here nor there in the end.
You used a really interesting word about him when you wrote about him, which was how you thought he felt about himself, which was that he was quite mortified.
Well, I think he was mortified to be under house arrest in the middle of the Norfolk countryside on an accusation of alleged rape. I mean, this was a man who, of quite fierce moral conviction, you know, he had brought to the world's attention, we mustn't forget, the absolutely unlawful and unethical abuse by governments of information system in reporting casualties in war situations. That those war logs that he had released and the ambassadorial cables gave a vision of how power was being abused by governments around the world. Let's never forget that in discussing him. his personal flaws and his personal mortification over these accusations had brought him to a place far distant from his best work. He was a guy who could really hold governments to account and taught us how to expect more of the law when it came to privacy and public secrets. So for me, he was somebody who was caught in a very bad place, and I think still is in that embassy that he's resides in still. But with any luck, he'll get back to his work at some point.
How do you think the internet has affected the way we tell stories?
I think the internet does so much of our external living for us that it used to be that writers would have to go out into the world to see what it was like. It's possible to conceive of a generation of short story writers and novelists, and playwrights even, who don't leave the house, but feel utterly connected to what's happening in Japan and Australia and, you know, the Deep South in America. And, you know, they can get live streams of every sort of information from television series in America to, you know, award shows to government secrets, you know, that we now are able to tap into almost a kind of neurology of human experience through the internet. It's absolutely fundamentally altered our way of being alive. And so writers might want to turn their attention to that and are beginning to, I think, more, that mass mind that we now see in front of us. It doesn't take away your granny's parlour and the slow life that you lived when you walked to school swinging your bag. I mean, the internal life of human beings is capable of absorbing and reflecting any amount of contrasts. But I have to say that the new world of the internet is a universe of significant data and experience that we're all plugged into now, whether we want to be or not.
You wrote a long piece about a young boy, a deceased boy, called Ronald Pinn for the London Review of Books. Tell me about how you discovered him and why you wanted to explore his life.
I think the essay came almost as a kind of natural progression for me from all that interest that I'd already had in how the internet was affecting our imaginations and our sense of self. That selfhood itself was something that was being not obliterated by the internet, but made strange. And so I was walking through a South London graveyard one morning and I saw a grave, said Ronald Pinn died 20 years old, 1984. And I began to think about what the Metropolitan Police had been doing in London, using false identities, stolen names from gravestones, to invent a whole new life and a whole new narrative by which to live. And they did the surveillance work under those new names. And I thought that there had to be a moment, it was almost an Orwellian exercise for a writer to take the moral difficulty of that and really crack it open. So I took Ronald Pinn's name and started to look for the real Ronald Pinn's life and family and past, and discovered there was almost nothing about him on the internet. He'd lived and died before the internet existed, but then started to map onto him a brand new invented Ronald Pinn that I invented, and was able to get passports and create an internet life for him, which was large. So he became a fictional character who lived large in reality, a much realer life in terms of the internet age than the real Ronald Pinn ever did. So that kind of conundrum, I think readers who are hungry for an understanding of what's happening to our sense of story and our sense of lived life, they want that, and I wanted it. I wanted to find that story, and I spent a lot of that year basically fashioning a person who never existed in that way.
And you had some contact with his family. So how did his family feel about this?
His mother and I had fantastic conversations before the article was published, that we had the kind of interaction that as a writer is so meaningful to you, because I got the grain of his life, the real Ronnie Pinn's life, from his mother, a woman in her 70s, living alone in East London. But then something else that's also an aspect of how we live now intervened. The article was published and became quite well known. The Sunday Times then ran a story about my story. And Mrs. Pinn then had a much more troubled feeling about the whole experience, feeling the question of her Ronald's essence had been compromised, that his story had been taken, that writers steal lives. In a sense, that's why I gave the title of my talk at the Abbey Theatre Symposium this week, Stealing Lives, because I think to some extent writers do steal lives, and I wanted to open that up. And I think it should be opened up much more because it's at the centre of what we do. And it's not a simple matter of good or bad. Like most things, it lives in that vast grey area in the middle.
And thanks there to Andrew O'Hagan. If you'd like to read more of his work, go to the London Review of Books. And his latest novel, The Illuminations, is published by Faber and Faber. But remember to keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter at Bookshow RTE. Thanks to the production team, producer Regan Hutchins, and series producer Zoe Cummins.